All right, everybody, hold on a bit. The text is going to go out a little late, so we don't have any questions right now. Calls are really light, just the text hasn't gone out. So give us a couple minutes, and we'll get started, I hope. Hold on. All right, everybody, we're going to go ahead and get started. The text message went out and calls are starting to come in, but I'll tell you right now is your best chance. We have very few questions right now, but I'm sure they're going to pick up. If you have a question, a comment, a topic, anything at all, press 1 on your phone right now. If you do it in the next 30 seconds, I guarantee we'll get to it. They're rolling in quick. You better hurry. Here we go. We're going to get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and we answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight work. The list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone, give me a call. I'll do my best to get you an answer. We're going to get to those calls in just a little bit. A couple things to remind you about. It is the fourth quarter. Winter's coming. If you don't have a start module, the ESM, the Maxwell Engine Start Module, you really need to get one. Between the engine start module and synthetic oil, you will not be stuck anywhere, no matter how cold it gets, with a truck that won't start. The start module is absolutely amazing. Synthetic oil will keep the engine turning over nice and easy, no matter how cold it gets. And you won't be doing jump starts or being stuck somewhere with a dead battery. The start module is really amazing technology. It replaces one of your batteries and is designed just to start the truck. And it does that better than anything else you could put in. There isn't a battery on the planet that'll start your truck better than the start module will. And it's wired directly to the starter, so you don't have to worry about parasitic loss from anywhere else in the truck. So great technology. If you don't have a start module, get one. You can get it at our website, by the way, letstruck.com/store. Also, it's time to get your order. I'm not going to go through everything, but we have a program to help anybody. No matter how far behind you might be on accounting or taxes, we can get you caught up. We have software if you want to do it yourself. We have programs if you want us to do it for you. We have the best tax preparers who focus completely on owner-operators and trucking, so we know all the rules. Speaking of the rules, the per diem has changed starting October 1st of this year, so if you're using our software or our tax service, we know that our software is already updated. All you have to do is put in the number of overnights. You don't even have to know that the rule changed, and our software will calculate it correctly for you. If you're using our tax service, we will ask the right questions to make sure we get your per diem correct. But if you are using anybody else for your tax return, be very, very sure that you understand the per diem. And unfortunately, you're going to have to check up on your tax preparer. We see that mistake way, way too often. And now when we have a per diem rate change, and it happens during the year, October 1st, you need to be very, very careful that you get it right, and you've got to know enough to ask your tax preparer so you can figure out if they know enough. to use our software or our tax service, and you won't have to worry about it. Any questions about any of that stuff, you can just give us a call. It's 855-800-FUEL, 855-800-3835. I'm going to get to some phone calls. Let's go to Wyoming. Brad, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how's things today?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a couple questions for you. One is probably a pretty easy one about the keto diet. I've been very faithful to it for about a month, maybe 6 weeks. I noticed some change. I feel better, but I don't. My weight loss, I don't think, is where it ought to be, but I'm not, as long as I keep feeling better, I'm not going to worry about the weight loss. I figure that'll take care of itself. I know you had mentioned about, for urine test strips to see if you're in ketosis.
Right.
Where can I get those?
You know, probably the two easiest places to get them. I don't know where you might find them, you know, at
a
physical store.
Around.
Yeah, and I, you know, it's just so much easier these days to get things from like Amazon and eBay. And those are two great places to get the strips. So eBay, you can find some great deals on them. Amazon, you can always find them on there. That was what I was going to recommend because, I realized that the weight loss isn't important for everybody. But if you've got excess weight, and we all know whether we do or not, if you've got excess weight and you are truly ketogenic, the weight should come off. And if it's not coming off, that's probably a good indication that we may not be ketogenic, that we might be getting the macronutrient balance a little off. So even if it's not important, it's an indicator. So now here's the thing. If you start eating differently and you feel better, well, that's a good thing. I mean, that's one of the best indicators that things are going right. But if you, you know, get the strips, pay attention. You know, you don't have to measure this stuff for the rest of your life. But I even went back the other day. I started using MyFitnessPal again, which is an app on your phone where you can log your food. And then it will tell you your macronutrient balance. And I'm not going to do it forever. But every now and then I go back to it. If I've changed the way I eat, I've gone to eating the last couple weeks a lot more salads and vegetables than I was, and it's mostly because I was craving them. And so now I want to go back and kind of check my balances again for a couple days and see what's going on. I'm still ketogenic because I check my blood levels. So it's not like you're going to have to count this stuff for the rest of your life. But especially in the beginning, it does make sense to track your food for a week or two and see that you've got that right balance of fat, protein, and carbohydrates.
Right, because the only carbohydrates I would be getting would be what would be in things that I'm eating on the road that are prepared. Which, to be honest with you, I eat a lot of chopped salad, broccoli, things like that, cashews, almonds, macadamia nuts. That's pretty much what I'm existing on. And so it's the only, I'm not getting any, I have no outside carb source, I guess is the only way I can think to put it.
And,
I eat grains, no sugars.
Excellent. That's good.
So I'm looking at the weight loss. Yeah.
Yeah, so we can pretty much tell you've got the carbohydrates low enough. Based on what you're
telling
me.
Right, that's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping my protein isn't too high.
That's usually where it ends up being. You know, it's easy for us to look at the carbohydrates and go, okay, they're gone. You know, I'm not eating any carbohydrates at all. And we don't need to eat any. So when people start this, if they go really low carbohydrate, that's a good thing. We do want to eat protein. And that's where we usually have a hard time because it's amazing how fast you can eat too much protein. It adds up really fast. I've looked at cuts of meat where just like 6 ounces is like 35 grams of protein. Well, I'm only going to eat 80 to 100 grams of protein in a day. And if I get 35 of them from 1 6-ounce portion of meat, you could see how quick and easy it would be to overdo the protein. So that's the one you probably want to count. You could probably just ignore your carbs. It sounds like you have them almost eliminated, which is good.
Yeah, I mean, like whatever little bit is in nuts and stuff, that's all I get. What about eggs?
Eggs are excellent. I mean, eggs are a really, really good food because they do have a nice balance of fat to protein and a ton of other nutrients, and they're really easy on your body. You know, digesting eggs is, they're really digestible. Very, very few people have any kind of negative reaction to eggs. So,
yeah, because I do a lot of omelets, really bacon and cheese, sausage and cheese, things like that of omelets. So I do a lot of those.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, one of the things you might want to consider is when you do your omelets, let's say you were going to do a 3-egg omelet. What you might want to do instead is a 4-egg omelet, but get rid of 2 of the egg whites.
Okay.
So the yolk is where all the good fat is. The yolk is where all the good nutrients are. The white is mostly protein. And if we're trying to get that fat-to-protein ratio better and we're trying to get more nutrients, start looking at times where you can eat just the yolks and get rid of some of the whites.
Okay. And my other question, I had talked to you a few weeks ago, I was looking at an 03 Volvo with ISX.
Okay.
I hear music. And
hold the thought. I'll get to a break. We'll come back and we'll talk about that. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. I'm going to get right back to the calls. I was talking with Brad in Wyoming. Brad, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I had talked to you about this 03 Volvo with an ISX. I did buy it. I found out it was a pre-EGR ISX. I just bought it last week. I don't even have it yet. It's got 750,000 miles on it with a 3-pedal auto shift. My question about it was, I don't haul a lot of weight. I haul 40,000 is about maximum that I'm going to haul. And I heard you talk a while back about changing from a 6x4 to a 6x2 drive. Because I had given thought to dropping an axle out, and I was wondering if going to a 6x2 would be a lot less money and almost as effective as dropping an axle.
Well, here's what I've actually helped a couple other guys do. They're in an operation where they know they can haul light enough that with the right trailer, they could scale it with a single axle tractor, which would be a 4x2. So, and if we drop that front axle and the power divider, just get rid of it completely, build a drive shaft to the rear axle, and head out. That would be your most efficient setup and the cheapest. I mean, I've done that conversion. I've had shops do that conversion for me free because I give them all the parts. You just take all the parts. All I want you to do is the labor. Now, in your case, you'd have to decide if you have a way to keep the parts, and if we drop the No, I would even say get rid of it. Just let them take the parts, cut the best deal you can. And then if something ever changed in your operation and you needed that axle back, then you could just put in a lift axle.
Okay.
So you have a 4x2, if that works, you got to go through your weights and see. You know, the easiest way to make a 4x2 work is with a spread axle trailer. Then you've got a lot of flexibility because we can carry so much more on the trailer then. So that's one
single axle trailer. It's I haul cars and campers.
So when you say 40,000, you mean gross, not 40,000 payload.
No, that's gross.
Oh, then I would go. I would drop that forward axle and power divider in a heartbeat.
Okay.
Yeah,
and that would,
you know,
that
again,
up my mileage considerably.
Oh yeah, you'll pick up a half mile per gallon. Now, you know, do the math, make sure you can carry your weights and all that, and you know that. But if you can, I would just drop that axle completely. And, you know, if anything ever changed or you wanted to go back to hauling more weight, then you could just throw a lift axle in there and still end up with all the benefits of not having that differential and power divider.
Right, because I know you had talked, I had heard that one call about basically disconnecting the rear diff and just running off the front or something like that, you would say.
That's not my favorite. People were asking me about that. It's not the way I would do it. That's not my favorite way of doing this. There are some downsides to that. But in an operation like what you're talking about, dropping out that forward axle and power divider makes a lot of sense. Like I said, I've been doing it for years because at FedEx pulling doubles, I only needed a single axle. Tandem single axles on the open market are actually more expensive. They hold their price much better. So I would just buy tandem axles, and I had a shop that would just do the work free, and they'd keep the parts.
Okay. All right. Well, that's what I'll look around for.
All right. Good stuff.
Hey,
thanks for the call. Let's head off to you're welcome. Let's head off to Iowa. Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I saw your sign for the race. Your ketones were too low to run, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's my excuse anyway. The real reason I just hate running, so.
Okay. I got a question.
Okay.
You know, the Amish people have been so successful. And the only reason I'm bringing this up is because we've been in Amish country out in Indiana and Ohio, and I've talked with some of the farmers out there and the Amish business owners, okay? And it just kind of baffles me how they've done it with just an eighth grade education, and they don't go to banks to get money, but they're successful. There's no bankruptcy, okay? They don't lose.
Right.
So I just sit back and scratch my head. Is it just because they have such a simple life is the reason they're so successful? And how do I learn about their way of business?
Yeah, any time we look at a society like that, that is, I'm going to use the word radically different. And that doesn't mean good or bad. It's just radically different from the way most of us live. I don't think we're ever going to be able to pinpoint any one thing that is the reason. We have to look at everything going on. And I know quite a bit about the Amish lifestyle and Amish business for a couple reasons. I grew up not far from the Amish in Ohio, which is a very, very large Amish community. And when I first started driving, that was my area. I literally spent all day, every day, doing 15, 20, 25 stops a day in that whole area from Worcester out through New Philadelphia, all in that area, which is huge Amish. I spent a lot of time down there. I've also read many books about Amish culture and Amish life just because I'm interested in, you know, different ways that people live. So clearly, one of the reasons they are more financially successful is that they do live a very simple life. They don't spend a lot of money on material things. They've owned the land for generations. They tend to build all their own buildings, and it's a community effort. They raise most of their own food. They don't normally, there are always exceptions, they don't normally have any automobiles or expensive machinery. So they have a very simple, inexpensive lifestyle, and they tend to just work to provide what they need. They work to provide their own food. They make their own clothes. They, you know, build their own buildings. They fix just about everything themselves because their equipment is fairly simple. So a lot of it is they just don't spend much money, and they provide their own stuff. Now, they're, for the most part, probably healthier because they're eating the food they raise. They're more physically active. So there are clear, they are living the way many people lived 200 years ago. I mean, that was the norm. More people lived like that 200 years ago. We didn't have a lot of things to spend money on. We didn't have automobiles and expensive equipment. We tended to live a more rural lifestyle, eat healthier food. They just haven't changed much. They still live the traditional way they've lived for hundreds of years. Almost all the research I'm doing about nutrition and health says this isn't complicated. All we have to do is just get back to what we used to do. We did it for thousands of years, and people were healthy, and we didn't have these diseases. So there's the health side, and then the money side. They're kind of tied in. They also have very, very strong community support. They're very family-oriented. And that's another big thing that we've gotten away from. You know, we used to live, generations would stay together. You know, you would have parents and children and grandparents all living together, sharing the responsibilities. And I think that was a healthy way to live. Now, we all run off and do our own thing. Parents are working too many hours. Kids are in all kinds of activities at school, after school, sports. We've got all the electronics. We could just go on and on, but the real lesson here is that all of our technology, as much as we love it, and I'm right there with a lot of people, most of it has not been a real improvement in our lifestyle. It's been a very negative influence on our health and our money and everything else. So I think the lesson is, the closer we get back to living the way we did for centuries, I think the healthier and happier we could be.
Okay. And I totally agree with you. I mean, just to see how that community works is just awesome. And I just so wish trucking could be more like that.
Or just people in general. But you know what? I don't really see it happening. In fact, I see the exact opposite. All of our modern conveniences, technology, it just keeps growing at a more rapid pace every year. And we see people sucked in more and more, not less. I think what you may see is a split. Just like we have economically, I think you're going to see a split health-wise. Some people are going to get it. There's a movement in that direction, and they're going to be happier and healthier, and other people are going to continue heading in the wrong direction. There are certainly good lessons from those traditional cultures, though. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to get right back to the phone calls. We're off to Oklahoma. Les, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How's it going today, sir?
Good. What can I help you with?
Okay. I have the goal of getting my own Kevin Rutherford special truck in March and hopefully signing on Landstar. Now,
okay.
What I would like to do is go ahead and start establishing business credit so that I look like I, well, so that I have more resources for me in case I need to do a in-frame or anything like that. My thoughts are this. My bank has a business line of credit that is secured by certificates of deposit. I'm thinking about beginning to buy some of those and putting them under a DBA just to build business credit. What do you think about that idea?
Well, let me just clarify. I love the idea of having the savings, using the savings to help with a line of credit. Now, let me just clarify something, though. First of all, I love the idea. But even though your bank is going to call this a business line of credit, what we need to do is clarify what really happens in the business world. The bank may or may not, with the certificate of deposit, they're probably good because depending on how they write the contract, if that's truly collateral, that may be enough to get that line of credit that they'll call business. But I will tell you that almost nobody on the planet is going to give you true business credit. They are always going to make you sign personally. I mean, even today, as long as I've been in business, as successful as our current business is, even with lots and lots of revenue, no debt, and cash in the bank, nobody will give me a business loan, a true business loan. They will make one of the principal owners, at least one, and sometimes all three, they would make us sign personally for that loan. Now, it can have the business name on it. It could be considered a business loan, but we will have to sign personally as well. And if the business were to default on that loan, then we would be responsible personally for it. And that's just the way business works. And you know, if you think about it, it makes sense. I mean, if I were to go out and borrow a bunch of money and the business was the only one responsible for it, it would be easy for me to bankrupt the company, keep the money, never pay it back because I'm not responsible for it, and just go start another business.
Right.
So Nobody wants to take that kind of risk. I mean, you've got to get to the point where you are a pretty good-sized company before they will truly give you business credit without you signing for it. So I want you to continue on that plan because it's a good idea. I just want you to understand the difference that even after being in business as long as I have been, the size of my business, nobody's going to give me a true business loan.
Okay. Now, when it comes to working with brokers and other things after I grow up a little bit and get my own authority, does good credit rating actually help with street cred with brokers, or do they give a damn?
No, they don't even check. They could care less what your credit is. It's actually the other way around. The owner-operators working with brokers should be checking their credit. They should be checking their ability to pay on time. Really, the issue. When you haul a load for a broker, you are extending them credit. You're saying you're credit worthy. I'm going to go do this job and I'm going to hope you pay me later. So we need to be verifying that they have good credit standing, and they could care less the other way around. Let me also say this. Good credit rating is fine. It should be a part of your business and your personal finance, but I've really, and the older I get and the longer I've been in business, and part of it is because I'm able to now. There was a time where I had to borrow money, where I didn't have to. It was a choice of either borrow money to grow things a little faster or wait, and I chose to borrow money. The longer I'm in business, the less I borrow money. I mean, our business right now is debt-free. We've never borrowed a penny for this business since 07. I financed the startup out of my retirement account, which I don't always recommend either, but that was a choice we made. And we have, over the years, we've looked at it. Should we go borrow some money? We could get a project done sooner. And we've just made the decision to work just on cash. When the company has money, we'll go do a project. If we're running short on money, projects may have to wait. We could have accelerated a lot of things by borrowing money, but you can also get yourself in a lot of trouble. You can borrow money when things look rosy and great, then the economy turns, something else changes in the business, pretty soon you're struggling to pay it back. And that could happen to anybody. So
yeah,
I just prefer to work on as much cash as possible.
That's one thing that you and Dave Ramsey have said, that avoid risk as much as possible, and being debt-free avoids a bunch of risk.
It really does. I mean, you know, we're in pretty good shape business-wise. We always have cash around for things, and we're not borrowing any money. So if things turn really south tomorrow, for whatever reason, well, let me give you a good example, something I push for all the time. If you know, something magical were to happen and we were to get the fair tax tomorrow, we'd lose about 30% of our revenue. I'm okay with that because I think the fair tax would be amazing for the country, and I'll find another way to make up that 30% revenue. But if we lost 30% revenue and we had a ton of debt, and then right after that the economy turns south for some other reason, that can be enough to wipe out a business sometimes. On the other hand, if I don't have a lot of debt and I have cash and we lose 30% of the revenue, it would suck, but we'd survive it. And that's really where you minimize the risk.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate this, and y'all have a great day.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. So I'm not against borrowing. I'm really not. And I'm probably much more lenient on that than Dave Ramsey. He's a very, very strict, do it with cash, don't borrow money. I get that. It takes a lot of the risk out of the equation. I have borrowed. I've helped other people figure out how to borrow, but I always, you know, look towards doing it with cash flow instead, and I lean that way. I'm not totally against borrowing, but I do it in very controlled situations. Let's go to Key. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Kevin, the other day I called, and I forgot to ask you the big question that I called you about. I looked and I bought some grass-fed beef, and I told the guy I wanted the fattiest cuts that I could get, and he told me that grass-fed beef is not fatty. So I said, well, what do you suggest? He said, get the hamburger. He says, that'll give you a good idea. That's about as fatty as I've got. Okay, so I know it's better for you.
Uh-oh.
What's the matter?
Oh, well, you broke up there for a second. Say that again.
Okay. I say the grass-fed beef has very little fat content to it. And
right.
I asked him what would be the best for trying. He suggested hamburger. So, oddly enough, this fella just happens to be a partner to one of my doctors, and I just happened to call him. So I met him up there, and my wife met him up there and picked that up. And there's just no fat in hardly at all in that beef. It tastes good, but there's a very low fat content in it. I'm wondering, you know, I've got a little problem, I think, with having too much protein. I called the other day. Remember, I can't get my doggone ketones up over 0.5, 0.6, 0.7, and I'm not eating any grains, any proteins, and my sugar is way down, though. But I'm wondering, with the grass-fed beef, what portion size would you suggest a guy try? A 4-ounce piece, a 6-ounce piece, I mean, I used to eat beef,
those are 4 and 6 ounces are good meal sizes, and then add a lot of fat so that you feel more satisfied. So, you know, good mayonnaise, cook it in butter, Add more butter if you're going to have vegetables. Add salad oil. Sometimes just topping even meat with a good avocado oil or a good olive oil is enough. You know, a tablespoon of oil adds a lot of fat. It adds flavor. It'll control your appetite. I've got some other ideas for you, though, and we'll come back and talk about that in just a second, because this is an issue. Grass-fed beef, bison, wild game, it's all very lean. And it is a little tougher to get the fat, but I'm working on it myself, so I've got some ideas for you. Stick around. Be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, a quick heads up. We're heading into the fourth segment of the first hour. That means when I'm done with this segment, I'm going to say goodnight, goodbye, all that stuff. But don't hang up, because we're going to come back and do another hour. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. I'm going to head back to Kentucky. John, you still with me?
Yes, sir.
All right. So, and I've been fighting, you know, some of this stuff myself. Same reason. I need to cut back on my protein a little bit. I want to get more fat. So some of the grass-fed producers are finally starting to catch on that people who are seeking out grass-fed are also seeking out, you know, good sources of fat. And grass-fed beef fat is a really good source of fat. It's got more omega-3s in it and less omega-6. So I just ordered some this morning. That ground beef, it was 78% lean, which means it's 22% fat. That's a pretty good ratio. That company, and it's Texas Grass-Fed Beef, and the website is texasgrassfedbeef.com, they also sell additional fat, just like pure fat. And if you want, you could just grind it in yourself, and it's not that hard to do. They also sell slabs of beef fat that a lot of people, when they're grilling or cooking a steak, for example, they'll just lay that slab of fat over it while it cooks, and the fat will melt down through the meat. Now, not only does it taste amazing, but it helps that fat to protein ratio. Some of the other cuts, like beef short ribs, tend to be very fatty. So those are some of the ways. You just keep looking for the fattier cuts. Buy some extra fat if we need to. Cook it in more fat, like, you know, pan fry your steak in beef tallow or lard. So, and then add more fats, whether it's, you know, if you're having a burger, put an egg over it. I mean, an egg, a lightly fried egg over a burger is really good, and it gets that fat content up. Make good mayonnaise-based sauces. Learn, you know, if you can, and I know this isn't always easy on the truck, but if you can learn how to make some of, like, a béarnaise sauce, a hollandaise sauce, those are typically high-fat sauces that are really good with meat. So it is an issue. It's not easy, but we just take little steps here and there just to keep that fat content up. And the other thing, if you're watching your ketone levels and they're not coming up, or you're getting up around maybe 0.7, 0.8, maybe getting to 1 once in a while, the other thing that will help is a little bit of activity. You don't have to go run miles and miles and miles, but if you just up your activity level a little bit, walk a little more, pick up a hobby that gets you outside and gets you doing something, you'll see that will help increase your ketone levels as well.
Okay, give me an idea, Kevin. the fellow that I'm getting my grass-fed beef from for hamburger, it's like $6.25 a pound. Is that what a pretty normal price?
That's actually a good price. I've certainly paid more than that. It is more expensive. There is no question about it. It's always going to be more expensive. And it's one of those decisions people have to make if they're willing to spend more. Now, I just tried, well, I haven't tried it yet, but I found, I don't know if you're familiar with Kickstarter projects. Kickstarter is a website where if you have an idea, a product, a service, and you want to raise money to get it started, you put the project on Kickstarter and you offer rewards and people kind of donate to the project to get it off the ground. And there have been some amazing products come out of Kickstarter. One of them that I just donated to, so if you look up ButcherBox and Kickstarter, you'll find it. And, you know, I say donate, but I think I went in at like the $250 level. But when the project gets launched, then I'm going to get 3 months worth of grass-fed and pastured meat for the $250. Plus, you pay for it up front. It helps the company get off the ground and get started. And they claim that once they're off the ground and started, they will be able to deliver pastured and grass-fed meats of all kinds, beef, pork, chicken, eggs, for about $7 a meal. So that's actually a pretty darn good price. I mean, you're going to spend $7 at Wendy's, you know. So if you can get really good quality animal products, all pastured and grass-fed, for an average of $7 a meal, that's pretty hard to beat.
Yeah, that sounds good. I have one last question for you. Bulletproof coffee. Now, I see how they mix them on a Bulletproof website, and they tell you to start out with one teaspoon of the MCT oil and work your way up. Yeah, but they did not explain it why, and I wonder if that has anything to do with that new product you have at the store called Disaster Pants.
Yeah, that's exactly the reason. MCT oils, yeah, I know. I love that phrase. It's pretty descriptive. MCT oils are so easily converted to energy by the body. They go through a very short digestion process, and they can have an effect on the digestive system early, and it's not pretty. But most people adapt to it really quickly. Now, I've kind of, you know, I'm still learning this, and I've been testing and trying things. I am not going to buy the MCT oil anymore. Here's the reason why. It was fine. I got great energy from it, but it is a more highly processed oil. I mean, they have to take coconut oil and process it down to the MCT oil. So coconut oil itself is about roughly 50% MCT oil. So they refine it down to where it's in the 90s. Well, you know, one of the biggest things about this diet is staying as close to whole natural food as possible. So my thought was, it's more processed. I'm going to try it. And if I see a real difference, maybe I'll keep using it. But I went through two full bottles of the Brain Octane and the MCT oil, and I compared it to just using real virgin coconut oil that was hardly processed at all, and I can't see any difference. I get the same energy. I have the same mental clarity. I tried all kinds of things to figure out if the MCT oil was better, and it's not. I don't get better results, so I went back to just virgin coconut oil. I'm not going to spend the extra money, and I'd rather have a more natural product anyway.
And how do you mix your coffee then? That's where I got in trouble. That book said two tablespoons of MCT oil, two tablespoons of coconut oil, and a couple other things. I figured, and that was for 8 ounces of coffee. Well, I like to drink 16. So I did four
right.
MCT oils and four
Ooh, yeah,
coconut
that's a
oil.
Lot.
and I could put the eyeball out of a doggone groundhog in the backyard at 50 yards just by turning around and bending over, you know?
So,
what the disaster pants are about.
Yeah, so here's my ratio, and this works really, really well. I don't have any issues whatsoever. I make 10 ounces of coffee at a time. For a 10-ounce cup of coffee, I use 2 tablespoons of grass-fed butter and 1 tablespoon of 1 tablespoon of virgin coconut oil. It tastes amazing. The energy levels are fantastic, and I have no issues whatsoever.
No gut issues. All right. And do you put anything like a little cinnamon or something for flavor?
I have a whole bunch of stuff that I kind of rotate in and out. I almost always put in a tablespoon of raw cocoa. I love that. Now, in the beginning, for a lot of people, that's a little bitter, but most people tend to start with. Yeah, but it's really healthy, and it tastes good after you get used to it. I also put in a product, and it's very high-quality, grass-fed, but it's actually gelatin. I put in about a teaspoon of that. It's really good for your joints and ligaments and all kinds of things. It's got a lot of protein.
And what is it called?
It's really good for... I think the company is Great Lakes. I found it at Thrive Market. You can find it at health food stores. It comes in a round cardboard container, almost like a salt container. And it's just good, pure gelatin. It's really the same thing that, you know, they make Jell-O out of, but that's like the worst quality you're ever going to get. This is really high quality, only comes from grass-fed animals.
Okay.
I'll put some of that in powdered, so you just, you know, dump a little bit in. And then I'll also, I will put in some cinnamon. Sometimes I'll put in a little raw vanilla powder. So I kind of mix things up like that. Sometimes I'll even put in a little bit of maple sugar. It has a touch of sweetness, a little bit of maple flavor, and it's got some nice trace minerals in it. So I try to get as much variety as possible and put some different things in there. Nutmeg, another good spice that is healthy and tastes good. So I have a whole little coffee bar that I kind of mix and match those things every day to get the variety. I'm all out of time. We'll see you back here next show. Be safe, be profitable, be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, here we go. We're going to do another hour.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome back, or welcome to the show. Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and we answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. The list goes on and on. We talk about whatever it is you want to talk about. If you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone, give me a call. I'll do my best to get you an answer. And the show truly is you, the listeners and the callers. I can start a show with my topic. I can bring up the things I want to talk about, but ultimately we talk about what the callers want to talk about. There has clearly been a shift in the last 8 months or so on this show, and the calls about health and fitness and diet and nutrition have grown. I realize some people don't like that. Some people want to talk about trucks and tires and fuel, and I do too, or taxes, financial planning. I love all of those topics, but we talk about what the callers want to talk about, and there's a lot of interest in health. I like it because I am doing a tremendous amount of reading and research, and I'm actually loving it. It's new for me. You know, after doing, you know, taxes and fuel mileage and tires for 20-plus years, there's not a whole lot new. I read a lot. I'm always looking for something. My mind's open to new ideas. I just don't find a whole lot. So for me, the challenge of learning all of this nutritional info has just been amazing. I spend just about 6 hours every day reading, watching videos, listening to podcasts, now studying a nutritional certification course. But I'm absolutely loving it. It's new, it's challenging, and it's helping a lot of people. So it is truly a part of this show now. And speaking about callers in the show, we're going to jump right into some phone calls. We're going to head off to Georgia. JW, welcome to the program.
Well, good afternoon, Kevin. JW Pennystacker checking in from Georgia. My thought or question or curiosity about flaxseed, specifically flaxseed meal, that's the ground flaxseed. You know,
yeah.
Where you mix up a batch and you can make one at a time in the microwave, and the neat thing about it is you can make it and turn it into a what I call a fat bomb, or you can go the other way and make it low fat. You kind of target it whichever way you want to go and personalize
yeah.
it by putting in all your little secret ingredients. The main benefit is a ton of omega-3s and the fiber. And I noticed on the ketogenic diet, fiber is, fiber's missing. So, you know, this kind of like makes for a better diet when you go the keto route. What's been your experience with flaxseed and flaxseed meal?
A couple things. Hey, if you look in my pantry, you'll see flaxseed meal. If you look in my refrigerator, you'll see flaxseed oil. And flaxseed oil, if you're going to use it, should be refrigerated because it's not very stable. It's easily damaged. You mentioned omega-3s. That is the clear benefit to flaxseed. It is one of the easier. The other way to get omega-3s, salmon, sardines, seafood, but it's tough to get in a good ratio. And the American diet is so high in omega-6, which is inflammatory. It does contribute to heart disease. We do want to stay away from a lot of omega-6s. We actually want, they say the perfect ratio in your diet of omega-3 to omega-6 is 1-to-1. The average American diet is over 20-to-1 in favor of omega-6. That's why we see heart disease, inflammation, all kinds of problems. Flaxseed is a good source of omega-3 and many times easier to get, you know, wild salmon and some of the other things, or sardines. If you don't like seafood, it's tough to get a lot of omega-3. The fiber thing, let's talk about that, and then I'll come back to the flaxseed as well. Fiber, like many things, is misunderstood because it's always been studied in conjunction with the standard American diet. And if you are getting a lot of carbohydrates cause digestive issues. And the wheat and the glutens and all the other things that come with most carbohydrates make those problems worse. And there was a theory that fiber helped. Well, it turns out it really doesn't. That fiber tends to help temporarily, and then the effect seems to go away. So people who are having digestive issues and then add a bunch of fiber, like we've been told, they do see benefits. It fixes things for a while. Most people with chronic digestive problems, though, fiber isn't doing them much good. Now, if you get away from that high carbohydrate diet, you don't need nearly as much fiber, and in some cases, you need next to none. The benefit of the right kind of fiber is that it will feed your gut bacteria and keep that balance much better. So things like insoluble and soluble fiber from, and there's also something called resistant starch. You can get resistant starch from plantains, from onions, garlic, leeks, asparagus. That is a really good source of fiber and resistant starch. So we don't need those grain fibers that we've always been told are healthy for us. They're not. They come with too many other bad things. So, yeah, fiber is good. Flax would be a good source of that. Coconut, though, is an amazing source of fiber. So fiber can be a part of a ketogenic diet if you need it to be. And if you're eating a lot of coconut products, you're getting a ton of fiber. Nuts have a lot of fiber. A lot of vegetables. So those are all good. Now, there's one other issue with flax. And that is that the nutrients that we really want out of flax, the human body is not able to convert them to the proper nutrients. The DHA, the EPA, the ALA, those are the specific fatty acids that we'd like to get out of flax, and our human body is not all that good at pulling it out. So we have to eat a lot of flax to get the true benefit. The other way to do it is there's a brand of eggs on the market called Christopher eggs. You can actually get them in Kroger. So if you can find a Kroger store, it's their label. And it has 660 milligrams of omega-3. And the reason why it's better is because the chickens are fed the flax meal as part of their diet. And they are able to convert the flax into the three fatty acids that we really want, and they are more bioavailable to our body when we eat them in the eggs. So, yeah, I do have flax meal. I do have flax oil. I use it. But I also, you know, I get these eggs. I do the sardines and the salmon because omega-3 is important.
Yeah, yeah. What, one other comment about people wanting to know how long the front diff will last. If you single out your twin screw, I got real
yeah.
world results. I got real world results for you because, well, that's what I did. 30,000
right.
miles and 30,000 miles, and you never know when it's going to fail. It's like, gee, my it slipped out of top gear. I wonder what happened. And then it's like, up, blew the power divider. No warning, no clue when it's going to happen. Then you're looking at a wrecker bill, and you got to fix it right away. So 30,000 miles is the answer.
Well, that was your answer. And that is valuable information. That is one case. But I have a case where I've singled out trucks and gone a million miles. We had, you know, Matt did it with a differential that already had a million plus miles on it and made it several hundred thousand miles. It really is all over the board. That's why there is no one answer. If we were starting with a brand new differential, we could certainly do better predictions. But even then, it depends on the weight, the driver, the terrain, all kinds of things. Ultimately, if you're going to build a 4x2, your best bet is a 23,000-pound axle. But if you already have one, I'm willing to go for it. I've done it many times and gotten lots and lots of life out of it. But thanks for the feedback. Let's go to Kentucky. Chad, oh, you know what? Hold on, Chad. I just looked at the clock. The music just started playing. I'm going to get to a break, and we'll come back right after this. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford.
Yeah.
Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. Let's head off to Kentucky. Chad, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I heard, I think it was last week, a guy asking if a 10-speed can be converted to a 13. That cannot happen. Now, there's a very, very limited few numbers of 10-speeds that can be converted to the 15, but there are very, very, very few of them out there. The only one I knew about was a classic my grandfather drove back in the late 90s. That 10-speed was able to be converted, but it's they're so few and far between. It's, I mean, you probably have better context to get that information than I could.
Yeah, you know, the other thing, and I appreciate that, the other thing we've got to watch is there are confusion when people call me about whether they actually have a 9-speed or a 10-speed. You know, there
right.
are 9-speeds where even though they don't show that one gear position, you can actually shift into it. And the gear position I'm talking about in most of them is if you put your truck in low, that very first gear. Most
right.
9-speeds show that you don't ever go back to that position. But if you do, there's a gear there on the high side.
Yeah, yeah.
So some people actually get confused about whether it's a 9 or a 10. Now, many of the 9-speeds can be converted to 13, but you're right about a true 10-speed can't be.
Yeah, that one, I knew of two trucks. Now, this is when I was 13 years old when I was riding my grandfather. Like I said, the Classic he had, and then there was an FLD down the street that had that same conversion, but those were the only two I knew about. The mechanic that did them said they're really, you know, they're real spotty in the trucks that can be done and the transmission that can
yeah.
be done to that.
Yeah, he's right.
But my, just wanted to clarify some things for some people out there that were considering it. Question for you, what's a good website I can go to for the ketogenic diet? That's all I need, and then you can get somebody else.
Okay. So are you looking for, like, a lot of different information about keto?
No, I'm looking at food because I'm kind of a picky eater. So I need a website that's a reference for the foods that fall under that. I've heard talk about cheese snacks, whole milk, that stuff I like, but, you know, I'm not really a big vegetable guy.
Well, you know, and vegetables don't have to be a big part of keto. They're really not.
Okay.
There's a ton of evidence to show that vegetables just aren't nearly as important as we thought they were. If you like to eat them, there's certainly nothing wrong with them. But if you don't like to eat them, there have been lots of societies and groups of people that lived without vegetables, and they were extremely healthy. So I tell people, if you like vegetables, eat them. If you don't, you don't have to get that crazy about it. As far as one particular website about keto foods, I don't have any one place that I go, but all you have to do is Google keto foods and start following links, and you'll find 1,000 ideas and 10,000 recipes.
Okay. How do you spell keto? I'm not very good on
Yep. Nope. That's fine. It's K-E-T-O. And then ketogenic is K-E-T-O-G-E-N-I-C. But if you just Google search keto foods, keto recipes, keto ideas, any of those terms, you will come up with more than you know what to do with. Let's go to New Mexico. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon, Kevin. I got a question. I've got a 379, and I bought the Pittsburgh Power, planning on dropping the stacks, looking at one of the trucks I follow off the fuel gauge, and looking for, to see what other folks have done with the same kind of equipment I'm running. That is one of the things that they've done, and I'm wondering if, is that easy to do? I'm fairly handy. I was thinking I could at least take the stack down myself and then just have the shop install it. But whatever the hangers are and things like that, I don't think I have them. And Pittsburgh Power, when I bought it, told them what I was intended to do. They asked me if I had room for it, which I'm assuming that I would, but I don't really know the answer to that. My backup plan was just to go to a single stack and leave it how it is.
Yeah.
If I can't put it underneath the cab.
Yeah, there's a couple options here, and I don't know, and Pittsburgh Power doesn't know if you have the room either. The only way to know is crawl under there. There's so many different configurations. Sometimes you can put it horizontally under the truck. Other times there's just no room for it. And so taking the stacks off, you're right, pretty simple. The hard part about that is what you're left with. You know, you're left with some brackets or some bracket holes, and we actually spent quite a bit of money on our project truck, you know, at the body shop, getting that to be smooth again and look factory. You don't have to do that, but that's something to be aware of. Putting the new exhaust on is not that difficult. It's actually one of those kind of do-it-yourself projects that I say, if you're willing to get dirty and give it a shot, it's one of those that you should try. You're not going to screw anything up. It's not complicated. If you get into it, find out, you know, you just don't have the ability or you can't figure out what parts you need, you can always run it down to the shop and let them finish it. So I think it's one of those projects that's worth trying to tackle yourself if you're interested. And then the next, you know, if you can't fit the muffler horizontally, then you can run your exhaust to the back of the cab, run a single stack up, and again, it's not that tough of a job. It could be a little challenging for some people, but it's worth, I think, if you're interested, it's worth trying it yourself.
Right. Well, I think I called in and asked about it as far as getting the, you know, economy for, and that was one of the suggestions that he had made. I mean, a half a mile per gallon, I think, was somewhere close to that by pulling the stacks out of the airstream. And that's, you know, if
we,
for a remodeling project that's not real expensive, that seems like it's money well spent.
We've done it several times. This is one of those things that we documented quite extensively because we had people come in, they had good fuel mileage numbers. That was the only modification. We took the stacks down and either built a weed burner with a Pittsburgh Power muffler or a single stack in the back, and we saw as much as 5/10 on most trucks. And the reason is you're improving two pretty major things. You're cleaning up the aerodynamics a little bit, which is big, and you're improving the flow because the stacks in front of the sleeper, the flow is horrible on most trucks. There's all kinds of bends and twists and turns to get back to those stacks, and there's a lot of back pressure. So it really is a good project. And like I say, I think it's one of those good do-it-yourself projects. Let's see. Let's head off to Colorado. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing today? Question for you regarding Super Singles. I'm running the low-profile Michelins right now, but I've got a guy that's trying to sell the Yokohamas and says they're basically the same as the Michelins as far as well, he didn't say rolling resistance, but he's trying to say that they're the same. My question is, the rolling resistance on the Michelin Super Singles are 89, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And what would they be on the Yokohama Super Single, Kevin?
You know, I'm going to have to go look that up for a couple reasons, because sometimes they change, and
mm-hmm.
the other one is I don't remember that one. I haven't looked at that one a lot, so I want to make sure I'm quoting the latest number, so let me go check those real quick.
Okay.
And let's do drives. And the wide single is the TY517, I believe. This is what drives me crazy about people who say things when they don't really know. When he's trying to say it's the same as the Michelin, but he doesn't even know what rolling resistance really is, he's just way wrong. I mean, the Yokohama might be a great tire, but the rolling resistance is 112. I can buy dual drive tires that are better than that and not bother with the rims and all the other stuff. Now, I like wide singles for a lot of reasons, but one of the biggest is that Michelin is 89. It's the lowest rolling resistance we can get in a drive tire.
Gotcha.
You know, we're going to lose 2.5 tenths, 2 to 3 tenths of a mile per gallon by having this Yokohama. That's $2,000
okay.
a year.
I got you. Absolutely. And, yeah, okay, well, real good then. That's what I thought. Didn't know exactly. I knew you would know, but I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Yeah, you know, unfortunately, there's just not a lot of education in the industry. And we still have people saying the same old stuff and just repeating what they've heard instead of actually knowing what they're talking about. It's easy to sound like you know what you're talking about if you repeat what you've heard enough times and you say it confidently. One of the best questions to follow up with people, ask them why. He says it's just as good as the Michelin Ask Why. See if they can explain it. Stick around. I'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're heading right back to the phone calls. We're off to the left coast this time. Raphael, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How you doing?
Good. What's on your mind today?
I talked to you about a month ago, and we went over my numbers. And the red flag was the insurance, so I went to my carrier, you know, tried to negotiate on to get my own insurance, so that went not well. I consider it kind of good because I ended up going out and buying my own truck, which I just bought this weekend. $10,000 truck, 10,000 FLD, Freightliner FLD.
Congratulations.
Thanks. And the only thing that it turned on, drove it for a bit, but my concern is it's been parked for about a year. So what do you know, like, what do I got to do before I get it on the road? Because I'm going to try to get it on the road as soon as possible.
Okay. Yeah, the good news is, you know, when we talk about trucks, even, you know, 2000s, those kind of things, the materials that are being used are much, much better than they used to be. We've always had this thought that when a truck sits, everything deteriorates, and some things do, but it's not as bad as most people think. I mean, the truck that I currently have right now, the 99 Volvo, it really sat for about 7 years with very, very few miles put on it. I mean, it might have gotten started once or twice a year for 7 years, and I ran into almost no problems. The one thing you want to look at is check the date on the tires. I'm pretty picky about tires. I will not run a tire that's more than 5 years old. I don't care how good the tread looks. I don't care how good the rubber looks. If the tire was manufactured more than 5 years ago, I replace it. That's and there's a date of manufacture right on the tire. So that's my rule of thumb. If they are right at 5 years old, you may want to take a chance. They may do just fine. But for me, 5 years, the tire's gone. I don't care how good it looks. You know, do a good inspection on hoses and belts. Fuel lines, I would replace as soon as your budget allows it. You don't have to do it right away, but as soon as you've got the money, I would put fuel lines as a priority. The crankshaft damper, crankshaft damper should absolutely be replaced. Again, you don't have to do it before you put it on the road. You can put it on the road, start making some money, but put it pretty high up there on the list. Other than that, it's really just looking at the things that might deteriorate. And, you know, if most of your radiator hoses look okay and the belts aren't, you know, dry and cracked, then you're going to be fine. We just don't see a lot of problems with trucks that have been sitting.
Okay, yeah, because, he gave me a receipt about 2 years prior he parked it. Brand new radiator, so radiator hoses. He calls it a half motor rebuild, but I consider it a whole M-frame. He spent about $15,000 replacing cylinders, pistons, heads.
That's an M-frame. It sounds like this is a real find. So the other thing I will tell you that I've seen, when batteries have been sitting a long time, and we charge them initially and load test them, they tend to test really well. But it's not that uncommon if a battery was sitting for a long time, it'll test well initially. But after you start using it and charging it and recharging it, don't be surprised if you have to put some batteries in this.
Oh, no, he threw in brand new batteries in there on top of
excellent.
It. So the tires, he says that they're about 2 years old since he bought them, roughly, but I'm going to look at the manufacture date. So I shouldn't have a problem then just getting it back to road condition then, right?
Oh, no. No, this thing sounds like it's almost ready to go.
Okay, yeah, because he parked it, and then that's when he bought a 2014. That's the only reason he parked it, because it's in California.
Got it. That sounds like a real find. Hey, let me ask you a question real quick, because you went back to your carrier. You said, hey, you know, I'm getting killed on insurance here. What happened? I mean, what led you to buying your own truck?
Well, they didn't. I asked them about my insurance. They said that's the insurance they got. So I asked them, well, I want to go get my own insurance. Then they said that their financing company might not let me get my own insurance. So from there, I tried to ask them, well, let me buy it outright. And they said that now they could do what they're only doing, you know, buy. It's kind of like buy here, pay here deal, you know, what's leasing.
Yeah.
So
you know what?
I was like, you know what? All right. So I went out and decided to buy me my own $10,000 truck. So
I think this worked out really well for you. And actually, they are borderline on whether or not they're even legal about this. If the company you lease to, they are absolutely not allowed to require you to buy anything from them. They can require that you have things, whether it's insurance or a tracking device or whatever. They can have those kind of requirements. They can't require you buy it from them. They can give you the parameters. They can say we need this much coverage and, you know, your insurance has to say this, but they have to let you shop the market and buy it wherever you want. Now, if they bring the finance company into the mix and say it's the finance company that requires it, then it gets a little tricky. The other thing is, even if they're being totally illegal about it, what are you going to do? I mean, take them to court? It's just not worth it. But I just want people to be aware. If you lease to a carrier, they can never require that you have to buy a product from them. They can't do that. That's illegal. I think this worked out really well for you. I think you found a great truck, and I think this is going to be very good for you. Congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Good luck. Keep me informed on how things are going. Let's go to Arkansas. Pete, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. My question for you is on those ketosis sticks, versus the blood test, how does it compare, like trace, small, moderate, and then so forth. You know, so we got when I'm comparing it, what would that be equivalent to the blood talk about?
Yeah, unfortunately, there isn't a real good way of comparing the three different ways of measuring ketones. You can measure ketones through blood, which is the most accurate, but it's also the most expensive and the one that's the most difficult because you've got to keep poking yourself all the time. There's the breath ketone meter, which is brand new on the market, and it's about $180, but once you have it, there's no other cost. Then there are the strips, the urine strips, which are the cheapest. The problem is there's no good comparison between the three. They show up different ways at different times, and the least accurate are the urine strips. What can happen is you only get ketones in your urine when your body isn't able to use them as energy. So the more adapted you become, the longer you are ketogenic, the less likely it is you're going to see it in your urine at all. Like some people will see it in the very beginning and they know that they're, you know, becoming ketogenic, but the longer they stay that way, after a while they don't show up in the urine at all because your body gets better at using them. The breath is kind of the same way. The longer I'm ketogenic, sometimes the lower and lower the levels in my breath go. The blood is the most accurate. Because as long as our body is producing ketones, they end up in our bloodstream. Even if we're using them, we'll see them because they keep getting replenished in our blood. The breath and the urine are actually kind of measuring waste products of ketones, and it's not as accurate. And there's no comparison. Some days when I check my breath, blood, they're almost identical. Other days, my blood will be very high and my breath will be very low. So there just is no way of comparing the three different methods.
Is there any way to know when, say, I've heard you talk about when your system is actually in high mode of burning fat?
You know, there are some ways without measuring your ketones. And, you know, I don't really think that you have to measure ketones. It's nice to know. But when we come back, I'll give you some pretty clear signs that your body is doing a good job of burning fat instead of sugar. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the ways you know or have a pretty good idea whether or not you're in ketosis. And ketosis simply means that you're burning fat as energy, not sugar. One of the quickest ways to know is appetite control. Most of us have been burning sugar our whole life, and we're used to that wild appetite where we're so hungry we're ready to chew our arm off, and we crave food, and then we eat, and then we feel bloated, and then we get hungry again, and we have to eat every couple hours, or we get a headache, we get shaky. You know, going 12 hours without food is difficult. When you become fat adapted, that all disappears. Your appetite normalizes. It gets the way it is supposed to be, and you're only hungry when your body actually needs calories. And because you have stored fat and your body is using it as energy, you don't have to eat all the time. Many days, if I get busy, I forget to eat, and I have to stop and remember. Some days I'll go 2 or 3 days, not without eating, but without eating very much. And then all of a sudden my body will say, hey, you're hungry. You need some calories. And then I'll have a day where I do eat a lot more. But that's a really good indication. The other one is that you'll start dropping weight. When you are ketogenic, if you have weight to lose, it will start coming off pretty quickly. Mood, you'll notice your mood gets better. You'll notice the sugar cravings start to go away. If you were to pay attention to all of those things, you don't need to use any kind of keto test. Can just go by how you feel. Let's get to some phone calls. Let's go to Indiana. Ed, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how are you doing?
Good. What's on your mind today?
Hey, first and foremost, Lisa told me it's okay for me to tell you you're stupid.
Oh, of course. You can always say that.
I'm sorry, man. Anyway, hey, listen. I want to ask you a question about a truck I'm driving, you know. But first and foremost, I want to talk about food. You know, in the news here lately, we're talking about all these companies, and I'm just going to use the egg as an example. This is just an example. But these companies are talking about, well, we're going to go to cage-free, range-free eggs, you know, and start selling, you know, all these restaurants and food institutions are signing up for this, right? You know,
right.
If this so happens, I have spent part of my career in the egg business, and no, I don't have the slightest clue about what the difference is between a cage-free egg and a range-free. I don't have a clue what the nutritional value difference is in the two products. Okay.
I do.
But here's the thing. Do you want to go to McDonald's and pay $6 for an egg McMuffin all because it's a cage-free, range-free egg? Is it worth it?
No, because those two words mean nothing.
Okay.
That's the biggest problem. It's not. I can tell you, here's what we really want to know. This is why I hate these labels. This is why I really don't want to use the paleo label or the low-carb label, because the food companies are really, really smart. They know the words that people are talking about. They know the words that are being used, and they take advantage of that by putting these labels on food when it is meaningless. The label,
right,
like natural. Natural means nothing. Hell, arsenic is natural, so is heroin. That doesn't mean we want to consume them. So the word natural means nothing. The word organic is starting to mean next to nothing. Cage-free, that is the biggest joke ever. That means nothing.
Sure.
All it means, the chicken could be sitting in a box its whole life with no room to move inside where it never gets sunshine and fed a horrible diet. All it means is it wasn't in a cage. Free range means nothing. Free range just means it was allowed to move around a little bit. It doesn't mean it was outside. It doesn't mean it had a natural diet of any kind. So the labels don't tell us much. So you're right. They actually probably cause more problem than anything. Here's what we want to know.
Go ahead.
I want to know, and I'm getting my egg from, spent most of its days outside being able to eat its natural diet, which is worms and bugs and things off the ground and grasses and seeds, and it wasn't fed corn and soy, and it wasn't loaded with antibiotics and hormones. It's just a chicken running around outside. That's what's referred to as a pastured chicken.
Right.
Now, I don't even like to use the word pastured because they're probably going to screw that up too. But so for the most part, I get my eggs from local people where I can go see that the chicken's running around outside.
That makes sense. Yeah, I mean, again, I admit I'm dumb about a lot of things. Even though I was in that business and been out, you know, actually seeing what goes on in egg house in that business, you know, I've seen all that stuff. But it just hurt me because, you know, the two biggest expenses in anything on the planet is the processing and the delivery of it from point A to point B, you know. And here we are talking about all this, like what you just said, and we're struggling enough as it is. And food, and particularly like anything else, has done nothing but get more expensive, and it always will. There are fewer, I don't know of any one product in that we can think of that where the prices actually went down. You know.
Well, no, there is and that's a problem in food, because one of the ways to produce cheap food is to produce it with no desire to make it healthy at all. And that's our processed food market. That's why people eat so much heavily processed food, is because it's cheap calories. You can buy a lot of food and a lot of calories for next to nothing, but you know, there's a saying among people who get this, and that is, you can pay the farmer now or you can pay the doctor later. It's going to cost you one way or the other. I've made
that's
a decision that I will spend a lot of money on getting real food before I'll spend it on a doctor or a prescription. And if you
right.
eat real food from a local source and you know how it's been handled, there is no question. It is expensive. Grass-fed beef is sometimes three times as much as regular beef. But the other thing that a lot of people find when they start eating whole, real food is it is more expensive, but after a while you start eating a lot less of it. Your body is being nourished, so it doesn't keep asking for more and more food trying to get the nutrition. You get the nutrition you need in a lot less food.
Right, that makes sense. Okay. Well, anyway, I want you to know, I mean, Kevin, I just learned something and I thank you for it. But I had to get that off my chest. You know what I mean? It's just
sure.
You sit here and hear all this crap all day long about well, we're doing this, it's this. And, you know, anybody in their right mind, when you process, you know, a lot of this information, you come up to certain, you know, conclusions, and it just drives you crazy, you know. Anyway,
yep, I know.
If you don't mind, very quickly, I want to jump to the next question. I'm driving an 08 Volvo, and this truck has basically been rebuilt from front to back. It's got a brand spanking new, I'm not talking in frame, a brand spanking new D13 motor in it. The only thing that's not been replaced in this truck that I think it might need is the bushings, you know, bushings and bearings. And it's got,
okay.
Right now I've got 910,000 miles on it. I think they're going to get rid of it sometime, maybe next year. And I'm just wondering, could you maybe give me an idea what you think this truck would be worth?
What year did you say it was?
I think it's an 08.
Oh, in my book, it's not worth scrap price.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't want an 08. I don't want an 08 anything.
I forgot to tell you, it's got an SRS. It doesn't have the depth, but it does have an SRS. And I know, you know, the region and other stuff. And go ahead.
It's got two rounds of emissions that I won't go anywhere near. You couldn't get, if somebody gave me that truck, literally said, here, it's yours, I would sell it, go buy something else. I mean, I would not run that truck to make money with. It's got EGR, and it's got a diesel particulate filter. So, you know, again, I won't own one of these trucks, so I really can't recommend them to anybody else. To answer your question, what is it worth scrap? I mean, I wouldn't pay anything for it, and if they gave it to me, I would sell it so I could go buy a truck without all that garbage. Whether that means a used glider, a new glider if you have the budget, or like one of our earlier callers today, a $10,000 FLD. We have lots and lots of people making lots and lots of money with pre-2000 trucks. It's still what I recommend. And I think it will be what I recommend for a very long time after I look at all the new emission standards again. It's going to be a mess. I'm all out of time. Thanks for joining me. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work. And master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, thanks. And I think we're going to skip recording tomorrow. So there won't be a text message going out. We won't be doing any recording tomorrow, but we'll see you back there Wednesday for a couple hours of Trucking Business and Beyond and an hour of Destination Health. So we'll see you then. Thanks.